This is Central Time. The new GOP health care bill aimed at replacing the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, narrowly passed the House yesterday and now heads to the Senate. And there are a lot of questions about how the bill could affect people with pre-existing health conditions.
The Affordable Care Act created more protections for people who had diseases, injuries, or other conditions before they got insurance. The new GOP health care law would give states the ability to apply for a waiver from that requirement. And Governor Walker said today that he would consider an option that would let insurers raise premiums for people with pre-existing conditions.
Bobby Peterson joins us now. He's the founder and executive director of ABC for Health, a nonprofit Wisconsin law firm that focuses on health care benefits and services. Bobby, welcome back to the show.
Hi, great to be here.
Well, there are a lot of maybes here, Bobby. This could change a lot on its way through the Senate, for example. The governor says we'll wait and see what this looks like, but he would consider this idea of opting out of the pre-existing condition requirement. Taking it now at face value, what we see out of the House, what could change for people with pre-existing conditions?
Well, it's a return to the bad old days of high-risk pools. I think the governor is looking through nostalgically with rose-colored glasses on at the past, saying that it was very popular. It was a limited option, and it really resulted in healthcare segregation for people. I mean, we identified people that had medical conditions that couldn't get regular insurance, put in 6-month waiting periods before they could start their insurance. It was much more expensive, and it seemed like with the Affordable Care Act, we had at least gotten past that issue. We had decided that we're not going to segregate care for people with pre-existing conditions. But we might be taking a step backwards.
And that segregated care you're talking about is this idea of the high-risk health insurance pool. That's if states, under this House plan, if states opted out of the pre-existing condition requirements, they would have to set up some kind of high-risk pool. The governor said, yeah, we used to have that before the Affordable Care Act. How did that high-risk pool work here?
Well, it was typically you had to be rejected for insurance by 2 insurance companies, so you would apply and they would say, "Oh, sorry, you've got pre-existing conditions, but here's information on the high-risk pool." So you'd apply for the high-risk pool, and you typically have a 6-month waiting period because you needed to go through some benchmarks before you got coverage. They did at times offer prescription drug coverage right away, which was good, but it was very expensive. It wasn't any type of family coverage. It was just for an individual. Premiums could run into the thousands of dollars a month for people, particularly people over age 50 and before Medicare age. So I represented a lot of people who had trouble with it, it's something I would dread having to go back to. I hope you don't see it again.
As part of the compromise that helped this plan pass the House, there were $8 billion set aside for people in this scenario, I guess, people with pre-existing conditions who couldn't afford health care. That's over a 5-year span. Is that enough money to make a difference?
Wow, that's a drop in the bucket. I mean, estimates are that about half of non-elderly Americans, have one or more pre-existing conditions. We're talking about people, above childhood age up to age 65. So that's a lot of folks, and when we start identifying that we need to either subsidize some of the coverage that they have, because otherwise it's going to be expensive, the people won't be able to afford it, and it may be that way already. So there's a lot of folks out there, and a lot of these folks are neighbors, family, friends, people that we care about, and to have them just get coverage through the high-risk plan and segregate them into that type of coverage is, to me, very wrong-headed and a real step backwards into the past.
When we say the phrase pre-existing condition, can you give us an idea of the range of conditions we're talking about?
Oh, it can be a lot of things. It could be something like, type 2 diabetes. It could be uncontrolled hypertension. It could be physical issues related to bones and joints, advanced arthritis. I mean, there's a lot of things that fit in the category of pre-existing condition.
And
it can be cancer, too. I mean, it could be very, very significant illnesses. So if you're uninsured and you're diagnosed with cancer, you might apply for HRSA, but you have a 6-month waiting period. Well, that's not going to help you too much.
And people have pointed toward genetic conditions, other things people might have from birth, as things that could lead to either rejection of coverage or substantially higher premiums.
Yeah, life is a pre-existing condition. I mean, it's just, there are so many things right now that, you could be born with. You could be exposed to toxins. You could be exposed to flu pandemics. I mean, there's a lot of things that can come up in life, and it's unfortunate that we're even having this discussion about going back to high-risk pools.
Well, it seems like it's one of the core problems of trying to solve health insurance, that or health care and health insurance coverage, is that the people who need it the most are, by extension, the people who are going to cost the most to take care of. And that's the thorny issue that any system is trying to solve.
Well, we have some good examples where, the pre-existing conditions aren't an issue. You sign up for Medicare at age 65, there's not a pre-existing condition test because there's a large group of people that are entering that. Medicaid doesn't have pre-existing condition limitations. So the larger the pool of people that are getting into, you can blend the risk. But if we want to have small risk puddles, which is, where we were back in the day, it means that insurance can get very expensive for people in small groups. But having large groups, and having everybody apply by the same rules like the current marketplace does allow to spread that risk, and, everybody is going to be in a better position ultimately, and particularly those that may have pre-existing conditions.
Bobby Peterson is with us, Executive Director for ABC for Health. We're talking about what might happen to people with pre-existing health conditions under the new GOP health care plan that just passed the House. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions or concerns about pre-existing conditions? Do you like the way this House health care plan deals with that issue? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation now with Bobby Peterson, Executive Director for ABC for Health. That's a nonprofit law firm that focuses on health care benefits. We're talking about what might happen here in Wisconsin with pre-existing condition changes under a new GOP health care plan. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and your questions. Nate joins us now in Milwaukee. Nate, hi.
Hi, thank you for having me. I am very either unimpressed or disturbed by what's going on. I was almost once denied health insurance myself because due to over-the-counter medication that I was taking, it messed up with one of the tests for the insurance I was applying to, and they initially denied me. I had to take it again later. But that shows how finicky the insurance companies can be. And I also know somebody who was in a car accident who, because of that, now has a pre-existing condition, grew up in Wisconsin. And if ever things about moving back here, I'll say don't do it because our governor will not look after your health.
Nate, thanks for the call. Bobby, your thoughts on, he says, even just a failed test fooled by over-the-counter medicines can put you in that pre-existing condition flag.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of problems with, the underwriting that occurs when insurance companies assess the risk of an individual. And, they don't know the cause of it or what, and they're going to go through your medical records with a fine-tooth comb, because it may affect profits. Yes, I think it's a problem, and those people that were identified with pre-existing conditions might get referred to the high-risk pool. I had a health insurance executive talk to me back in the days when we had pre-existing conditions. They said, Bobby, you don't expect us to provide insurance for a burning house, but these aren't burning homes. These are people that have lives and have medical conditions. And I think, that's part of the concern that we have, is that we need to make sure we take care of folks. And folks that have pre-existing conditions deserve to have health care coverage like everybody else.
Back to our callers. Thanks, Nate. We've got Laura on the line in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, Laura.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. I'm really concerned about this new bill because my husband is 60. He just retired on Wednesday. And I'm switching jobs so that I can pick up our health insurance starting in June. My employer does supply health insurance at this point, but I was born with a hereditary disease that will be fatal if I can't afford the medication for it. And my husband is a type 2 diabetic. So, I'm really worried about this because we could both have serious health problems without and not be able to get insurance if my employer will quit offering it. And the thing is, the employer insurance I'm getting is already a high deductible insurance.
Laura, thanks for the call. And Bobby, do we know how this plan in the House would affect pre-existing coverage for employer-provided health insurance?
Well, typically, you know, when you're in employer-sponsored insurance, you're part of a group, and there may not be the same type of underwriting as if you applied for a policy individually. It depends. You know, small groups have more challenges, and again, we're kind of stepping way back and you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago when we had to worry about these lot issues. I think her concerns are legitimate. You know, when you have pre-existing conditions, you're tied to your job, you're concerned about family members and loved ones. If you lose coverage, how do you maintain it? And, you know, Medicare is a few years off. So those are legitimate concerns. But remember, this is only a bill at this point, and there's opportunities to have your voice be heard. Speak up. Let people know what your concerns are. I think it's really important right now. Time is critical to make sure your elected representatives hear your thoughts about this.
Laura, thanks for the call. John is with us next in Colfax. John, hi.
Hi. Hello. This is John. I had a question or comment and would like to hear a comment in regards to you know, this insurance with pre-existing condition, what they're doing is creating different risk pools. And, you know, you open up the door for where are we going to stop with this risk pool? Are we going to divide everybody that may have, like, a cancer gene into another risk pool and keep on going? And then mainly my comment that I wanted to make is that, you know, our federal government already has programs that spread risk over a large group of people. When you look at FEMA, for instance, us here in the Midwest are paying money into our federal tax dollars that go for higher risk areas like the coastal regions.
Gotcha, John. We're just about out of time. I get your analogy. Bobby, as we wrap up, do you have hopes that we'll keep this wider risk pool in place, not taking things up?
I think John's right. We need to make sure that we have a large risk pool. We spread the risk, and then we can take care of everybody. And that should be our goal as a society and a responsibility that we have.
We'll leave it there for now. Bobby, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
That was Bobby Peterson, founder and executive director of ABC4 Health. He joined us to look at what could happen to Wisconsinites with pre-existing conditions under a potential GOP health care law. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. With each changing season comes a different crop of delicious vegetables. In the spring, we've got asparagus. In the summer, it's tomatoes and eggplants and zucchini.
And in the fall, we get the heartier squash. I look forward to that. And in the winter, root vegetables take their place on our dining room tables.
And we tend to think of our food world in four seasons, but our Food Friday guest says that vegetables actually have six seasons, and there are some steps that home cooks can take to get the most flavor out of their veggies if they eat them at the best time.
Joshua McFadden joins us now. He's a chef in Portland, Oregon. More importantly, he's originally from Wisconsin. He's the author of Six Seasons, A New Way with Vegetables. Joshua, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
Well, I understand you get some of your inspiration from gardens here in Wisconsin growing up. Can you talk about that?
I certainly do. Well, I grew up around farms all over the place in Wisconsin. I was born in Racine and grew up in the Waterford area. I went to school in Union Grove. My grandparents always had gardens, and my aunt had a big old farm, so it's very inspiring.
And you want us to think about that fork to farm or whatever direction it goes, farm to fork
farm to
world.
Fork.
There it is. In seasons, Joshua, but you don't think of it as four seasons, which is how we normally think about it. You divide it up into six seasons. Why go for six?
Well, I think it was more about a conversation about having the little micro moments of when things are at their best and also, most importantly, when they're not. I think that it's too easy to be able to go to the grocery store in January and buy tomatoes, and I just think that we need to get over that. It's not good for anybody, and they don't taste good. So I think the more in season you are, the more rewarding the food is, and it's just part of everything that's happening at that time. So it's kind of a little mini celebration.
Well, of course, it is the spring season here in Wisconsin. Got my first bit of CSA. The asparagus was there, ramps, chives, that sort of thing. What do you get most?
Ramps.
What do you get most? Well, maybe I'll ask you ramps. What kind of things can you do with ramps? What gets you excited about ramp season?
Honestly, it's actually one of my favorite pastas, and that's not even in the book. You simply just saute the bottoms and then fold in the greens at the end, which is very simple, just honestly, olive oil and pasta. But there's a really cool recipe in the book that does call for ramps, and it's kind of like a sweet and sour preparation where we take the ramps, and there's some plumped raisins, pine nuts, chilies, and then olive oil, and that goes on top of like a toasted bread with whipped ricotta.
Mm.
So that's really good. But then the other thing that's really fun right now is the asparagus. You said you had asparagus, which is amazing. And there's a really cool, really simple raw asparagus salad in the book, too, that's really fun.
Yeah, raw, and in the interest of full disclosure, I had asparagus. It's gone already. But I saw that raw asparagus. What's up with that?
Yeah, it's just, I mean, it's like, you know, my restaurant in Portland is Italian, and that's the style of food that I enjoy the most. And I think it's like most things should be raw. You should have like raw preparations when they're starting out from the garden and in the kitchen. And then kind of like you follow that through and all of a sudden you start realizing that the asparagus is juicy and it's starting to taste a little bit more woody, or it's even start not even cooking it at all and just let it go and move on to the next thing. But right when anything like asparagus, for example, comes in, it's so perfect just the way it is. So just do very little to it.
Sounds like that's kind of your thesis. When stuff first comes into season, you eat it raw, and then you wait a little while, and that's when you start to actually cook it, when you add the heat, you say.
Exactly. Like, corn is a great example, and in Wisconsin, even a better example. It's the best raw, honestly. Like, right when you first start getting corn in August, like, just right off the cob, take it off, and then toss it with a little salt, chilies, olive oil, lime juice. Perfect. And then the sugars in that will start, like, changing, and it'll be a little bit more starchier. And then at that point, like, cook it and do all the things that you would normally do with it. But, yeah, I'm a big believer in all the things just being raw and very simple at first and then kind of following that through.
Let's get to some of the recipes you've shared with us. By the way, we've got these on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm a big fan of beets. I like beets raw, cooked, pickled, you name it. You've got a beet slaw. This sounds great with pistachios and raisin. Talk us through that.
Yeah, that's fun. Oh, man. It's really funny. I don't even know where the inspiration of that one came for a while, but it's one of our definite big hits at the restaurant. And, again, that's raw. So, I don't know. It's just a really simple idea to kind of play with pistachio butter. Pistachio butter is actually a really traditional thing in Italy. I don't think that they're using it the way that I was, but it just kind of paired really well because, like, classic beet and pistachio always goes, but then just kind of playing with that as in that butter form, and it just kind of took off from there.
And Josh, you have a very particular method for dressing a salad, and it's different than I've seen before, where you kind of put the whole dressing together and then you toss it, you try to toss it thoroughly. You have kind of layers that you add one at a time. Can you walk us through that, since we're getting into the season where tender greens, these spring greens, are first coming up?
Sure. Well, starting even before you get the tender greens, I think that there's vinegars that are in the book that I call out, Cat being one of my favorites from Napa Valley, and really for what it is, I mean, you can mail order it, it's not very expensive at all, and it's just honestly probably one of the best vinegars that we've ever produced in America, and it's naturally sweet. They leave the grapes on the vine a little bit longer before they actually start harvesting it, and I've been using that for about 15 years now, and it was one of those first aha moments where it's just like you can literally put a splash of it into, like, sparkling water, and it's, like, very refreshing. And so that idea was, like, why would I mess with this, and why would I make vinaigrettes? Why would I just keep this very simple? And then it just kind of occurred to me that you can kind of really, like, start, you know, with lemon juice or, like, this vinegar that I'm describing, tossing the green or tossing the vegetable in that is exactly what you're trying to do, is add acidity to that and add a little bit more flavor to the sum of the parts. And then from that next step, then start adding a really great olive oil, because that has flavor as well and has the fat that binds it all together. And I really liked separating those things, and I feel like I've learned a lot more about food that way, of with everything, not just salads, but even with, like, corn, as we were talking about, or asparagus, like, making that taste great with the acid and with what you're trying to do first is almost enough. And then when you add a great olive oil, you're adding another layer of flavor to it. And I don't know, something that's always resonated. It's not even something that was ever, I wasn't taught that. I just kind of learned that on accident, I think.
I want to check out another recipe. Speaking of the salad territory, radishes aren't too off here, too far off here in Wisconsin. Radishes with tomatoes, sunflower seeds, and lemon. This looks like another simple one with flavors that sound like they're going to pop really well together.
Actually, it's radishes with tomato.
So not, you know what, you're right. It's that's two N's, and I read it as an F.
Yeah, yeah.
What? Okay, let's start
Which is
there.
Funny because if you text tomato, come up as tomato. Auto
yeah.
So you're not too far.
I auto corrected in my brain. What is tomato?
Tomato is it's basically like it's a tuna mayonnaise. So it just tastes.
That's
like
really
tuna.
Different than what I thought then.
Yeah, exactly.
You could substitute like tomato in that back and forth.
It tastes
though.
Like a tuna sandwich, honestly.
Wow.
Tomato is a classic. Italian condiment for a dish that they have over there. I've been using it for years as a condiment for dipping vegetables with crudités and with fried vegetables and basically anything you put at it is going to be great with it. That dish is awesome. It's so simple. Once you make the tomato once, then you'll understand what I'm saying because it just applies to so many different things. And we've never not had it at a restaurant, or I've never not had it at an event where somebody's like, what is this? So it's a really simple, very special thing, and then tossed with radishes. It's just a play on the idea of, like, the classic radish and good butter idea. Again, that fat kind of, like, taking away some of the bite and the fire from the radish, and then having that awesome kind of, like, fishy taste with the, and then the sunflowers kind of complement that.
And you've got a whole bunch of kind of simple sauces in your book that you can dip your veggies into. Are there any others you can walk us through that might be easy to put together?
I think they all are. You know, that was like the whole reason I wrote this book and broke it up like that. I read so many books, that's all I ever read. And I do it for a different reason. And a lot of books that I'm looking at are these chef-driven things, and they're kind of telling me more than teaching me how to cook things. And I just wanted to write kind of like a textbook, like here, this, do this, and this will go with this and this. Just as I said, the tomato, like once you make it, there's several recipes in it, in the book that apply, but then there's also like, it'll make a connection. You'll be like, oh, this will be good with this. So one of the other sauces that I love is a caper raisin vinaigrette, which is amazing with basically everything. Actually, when we're writing it, my editor was like, okay, we have to stop using this now on everything because it literally is that good. And for whatever reason, it tastes like Chinese food.
Yeah, it doesn't seem obvious, capers and raisins.
Yeah,
I totally stole that. It says it in the book, too. There's this Australian chef that, again, reading a cookbook like 3 or 4 years ago, and I saw this, and I was like, this doesn't make any sense. And then I made it, and I was like, wow. So that was like one of those aha moments. The other really, really good one is the spicy fish sauce. I think we call it spicy fish sauce. because it's not just fish sauce. It's kind of fortified with some garlic and some like fresh chilies, a little bit of water, vinegar, and a little bit of sugar to balance it out. That's really good too. I mean, that's again great with just like vegetables and cucumbers and fried things. It's great with steak. It's great with everything. Tomatoes.
And what are you most looking forward to? We're getting, you know, this is the very beginning, at least in Wisconsin. I don't know what it's like in Portland, but in Wisconsin, this is the beginning of the growing season. I think morels were at the market last week in Madison. What are you looking forward to?
Honestly, it's so funny. I mean, I know you've had a similar winter as we all have, I think, everywhere, which was a pretty shocking winter. So it's just it's so fun, honestly, when things just start coming in back in the season, like going through the asparagus or going through this, like we just got strawberries. And it's so fun to be able to be like, I haven't had a strawberry since last year, and I know like that, I don't want to sound like preachy or anything or like whatever, but it's so fun to eat like that. It's so fun to be able to be like, oh wow, this is clearly amazing because it's just like from today, pulled out of the ground. So I like going through all the seasons. I think it's like really fun. So I'm not really, there's nothing I'm in anticipation for. I'm really excited just watching it all happen right now. We're just starting to get peas, we have sugar snaps. Favas are coming in, like I said, morels, all the different mushrooms. So it's just really fun to kind of go through the whole thing.
Joshua, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much. Appreciate
it. That was Joshua McFadden, chef based in Portland, Oregon, and a native Wisconsinite. He's also the author of the book Six Seasons, A New Way with Vegetables. And he joined us on this week's installment of Food Friday, talking about the best ways to use vegetables at their peak.